For several lessons now, we have been talking about boasting on the part of the Apostle Paul. He's been sort of skirting around the issue, approaching it, backing off. In the first of this chapter, he approached it, he backed off, and then he digressed a little bit from going on to boasting. He talked a little bit about financial support and defended his policy. He defined the true identity of his opponents when he spoke of them as false apostles and described all of the things that they had done to these Corinthian Christians. But he's decided now he's returned to the subject of boasting, and he's going to boast as his Corinthian opponents do. And so let's look, beginning in verse 16, we'll read down through verse 21, the first half of verse 21, where Paul gives his basis for boasting foolishly. Again, I say, let no one think me foolish, but if you do, receive me even as foolish, that I also may boast a little. That which I am speaking, I'm not speaking as the Lord would, but as in foolishness, in this confidence of boasting. Since many boast according to the flesh, I will boast also. For you, being so wise, bear with the foolish gladly. For you bear with anyone, if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, if he hits you in the face. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. So Paul starts out here telling them that he's going to boast like his opponents do. He describes it as being foolish, and that is certainly the way that the Apostle Paul felt about it, because he's now addressing himself and talking about himself. And he has always said that such things are not boastworthy. They're not boastworthy on the part of anybody. Which of us as Christians could boast? Because Paul's already taught us in these Corinthian letters that we don't have anything that we did not receive. So how can we boast about something, you know, that we had nothing to do with? God gave it to us. And that's the way we need to understand things. But there was a danger, Paul recognized, that some might not understand that he was playing a part. So he tells them, now you bear with me, I'm speaking foolishly. And he wants them to know that he was playing a part. That he might be acting like a fool, but he wasn't a fool. Not like the fellow that somebody said, at first I thought he was playing dumb, and then I decided he wasn't playing. Well, Paul is somebody who could talk foolishly in boasting, but he was not a foolish person. As a matter of fact, Paul is saying that, you know, even if you think I'm foolish, at least I've got the right to expect that since you put up with their foolishness, you will put up with mine and listen to what I have to say, at least for a short while. And if you look at what Paul's doing here, it's at least to me, clear from the tenor of what he's saying here that he is embarrassed by discussing such a subject. And I think it conveys more powerfully the fact that he doesn't really want to do it than any denial on his part. If he just came in and said, I don't want to do this. But he speaks in a manner that gets that message across, and I think more powerfully than if he had just denied it. They might have said, well, yeah, he says he doesn't want to, but listen, let him go. But Paul is indicating to them that it's thoroughly distasteful to him. He doesn't want to do it. But as we discussed last week, for their sake, because the Corinthians are about to wander away under these false teachers, he's got to meet them on their own playing field and proceed on their basis. Now, the reason for Paul's embarrassment is now given in verses 17 and 18. And that is that self-commendation is not according to or after the Lord. Now, some folks look at that and they say, well, what Paul is saying here is that what he's writing in this spot is not inspired. But that's not his message at all. He's just simply saying that this is not the way that the Lord would have us speak. Christ would have us speak in kindness and gently. He wouldn't have us not speak in the manner of self-confident boasting, the language of the fool. But certainly it wasn't the example of Christ to boast about himself. Go back and read Philippians chapter 2, beginning about verse 5, where Paul describes the mind of Christ. Have this mind in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not a thing to be grasped to be equal with God, but emptied himself out. He was equal with God, but he didn't brag about it and try to hold on to it. He emptied himself. And Paul is saying, you know, what I'm doing now is not the way that the Lord would have us behave, but it's been forced on me by what's going on in the city of Corinth. We've already said that it's not Christian conduct. What do we have that we haven't received? In addition, it wasn't Paul's normal conduct. Look at Romans 7 and verse 18. He says, in the flesh dwelleth no good thing. And he's saying that these folks are boasting according to the flesh. Philippians chapter 3 and verse 3. Glory in Jesus Christ, he tells us, and have no confidence in the flesh. Perhaps the best statement is Galatians 6:14. Far be it from me to glory, save in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world hath been crucified unto me, and I unto the world. Paul is hesitant to talk as a fool, but his reluctance is at least partially, if not altogether, overcome when he remembers that his converts have grown accustomed to self-advertisement. That's what they're used to, that's what they seem to like, as indicated by what they put up with from these false teachers. Verses 19 to 21. Probably no verses in the epistle are more scathingly ironical than these verses. Paul says, not only do you Corinthians humor fools, you do so gladly. You seem to be rejoicing in it. You seem to like the way they treat you and what you have to put up with. You know, we hear a great deal these days about tolerance. We ought to be more tolerant. And by that, people usually mean, oh, you got to have an open mind. Some people do have a real open mind. They got holes in their head, it seems. Let me tell you, tolerance can be a good thing. But you cannot afford to be tolerant about the Lord's commands, because the Lord is not tolerant of disobedience to his commands. So, Paul says, you know, tolerance can only go so far. And you people are putting up with way, way too much from these people. You put up not only with the speech of fools, but also with the despotism of tyrants. Paul speaks of their foolishness as wisdom. You bear with the foolish gladly because you are so wise. Ooh, if I was drinking, that hurt. It almost seems that Paul is saying, you know, you think you're wise, but you talk about somebody who's acting foolishly. You take the prize. Or put it in the context of our class so far this morning, you get the red card. Paul gives five examples here of the indignities with which the Corinthians endured the false apostles, or endured from them. And Paul is not speaking hypothetically here. The implication is plain, so plain as to be almost explicit. He is describing what was actually taking place in the city of Corinth. He says, you know, you're being brought to a state of utter bondage. He doesn't say exactly to what they're being brought under bondage. It may well be that they were being brought under the ceremonial aspects of Judaism. But we don't know exactly because Paul doesn't tell us. But whatever it is, these folks are demanding that you do it. We know that was going on in Galatians, and we talked last week about the fact that there's some difference between these Judaizers and the normal Judaizer. These folks had adapted more to Hellenistic practices, but still, it probably had something to do with Judaism that they were seeking to bind upon them. Some folks even suggest, as a matter of fact, this suggestion comes, and this is not in the notes, by the way, comes from a book called Paul, the Apostle of the Heart Set Free. Isn't that a beautiful title? A book by F.F. Bruce. And he thinks that what was going on here, underscore the word think, he thinks that what was going on here was that these teachers were in fact trying to impose upon the Corinthian church the authority of the Jerusalem church. The first church, the mother church, if you will. And they came over saying, you know, you guys got to be subject to Jerusalem. Because apparently there was some effort to do that until finally they had the persecution in Jerusalem and they were scattered abroad, and that seemed sort of to bring an end to it, according to Mr. Bruce. Secondly, they were being swallowed up with a sense, in the sense that these super apostles or false apostles were living like parasites on them. Paul, you know, had refused to take anything from them. He supported himself. And these super apostles were sort of stung by that, and they were criticizing Paul. And Paul here says, you know, these folks are devouring you. They're living off of you. They're taking advantage of you. They're taking everything that you're willing to give them and perhaps a little bit more. And Paul does not say this here, but they may well be in his mind like those who serve not our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly. Look at Romans 16, 18, compare Philippians chapter 3 and verse 19. Thirdly, they stood by, as it were, and watched these imposters exalt themselves to positions of authority. These imposters didn't have any title to those positions. And once they exalted themselves to those positions, then they wanted to act like earthly potentates or rulers. And from that position, they wanted to lord it over the Corinthian flock. Perhaps light is thrown on what Paul has in mind here if you go back to chapter 10 and verse 5, where he talked about every high thing that is exalted against the knowledge of God. And that seems to tie in with what he's talking about here. In connection with the exaltation or self-exaltation by these, shall we call them upstart apostles. Whatever it is, Paul's clear implication is that it's worldly in character, but it's very carefully disguised by a thin veneer of sanctimony. Now, I'm not going to ask if you've ever known people like that, because you're all looking straight at me. But I think we can all go back in our minds and think of people who do that, and they disguise their self-exaltation by a thin veneer of sanctimony, almost holier than thou. Fourthly, they had entrapped them with tantalizing bait. They'd put on their airs of superiority, humiliation, humiliated the Corinthians, and had ensnared them or entrapped them, Paul says. And then finally, they even permitted these Corinthians to slap them, I mean these false apostles, to slap them in the face. Now, you say, oh, give me one of those boys. Let him slap me in the face, and he'll be eaten from the backside of his head, because I'll knock his teeth through his head. Well, Well, that's sort of the way maybe that we react most of the time. But keep in mind that it was not uncommon in Paul's day and age for people who were in positions of authority, either political authority or ecclesiastical authority, when they considered somebody to be speaking impiously, to either strike them or command them to be struck by somebody else. It happened all the time. These Greeks were used to it. The Jews did it as well. You remember when Paul appeared before the high priest Ananias, and he was not able to see that it was Ananias, and he made a statement that Ananias considered to be improper. What did Ananias do? Commanded him to be struck. And he was. It just wasn't unusual for that to happen. As a matter of fact, if you've always wondered why in the qualifications of an elder, Paul would say he should not be a striker. You know? Well, did you ever think that any Christian would go around just striking somebody? This helps you to understand why that's a qualification. He's going into a position of authority and he is not to be a striker. Well, I can't imagine an elder who would yell at somebody, much less strike him in the face. But in that day and age, it was a common practice. And one of the things that Paul says an elder should not be is a striker. We might take that and put it in a more modern condition, that he ought not to be a striker physically or verbally. It just doesn't work that way. None of Paul's readers or hearers of what was read would have failed to catch his message with its indictment of their inconsistency. Claiming to be followers of a meek and gentle Jesus, they were impressed and willingly submitted themselves to the aggressive authoritarianism of these false apostles. And they were unimpressed by somebody who was weak and considerate as a genuine apostle of Jesus Christ. And Paul confesses shame in really bitter, biting irony, that his character was too weak and his disposition too mild to use the tactics of the opposition. This is probably the peak of Paul's irony here. And he confesses shame when compared to these super apostles that he has been weak. And he simply seems to be saying that if these folks disparage me because of my weakness, and if that's really strength, then I admit to the fact that I am weak because I simply do not behave that way. If tyranny, greed, falsity, arrogance, and violence are the marks of true Christian oversight, Paul says, then I admit shamefacedly that as an apostle to Corinth, he has been a failure and a weakling. Now, if you can't get the irony in that, I can't make it any plainer. Paul has really, in essence, put it to him. And to the opponents, which is what he's trying to do. Well, Paul's heritage and trials, verses 11, 21b to 29. Paul, as we say, has approached boasting several times. He's backed off. He's come back now. He's stated the reason for his boasting, and now he's going to get to it seriously. where he's going to start listing some things. So let's read verses 21b to 29. Yet whereinsoever any is bold, I speak in foolishness, I am bold also. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as one beside himself, I am more. In labors more abundantly, in prisons more abundantly, in stripes above measure, in deaths oft. Of the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods, once was I stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and day have I been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of rivers, in perils of robbers, in perils from my countrymen, in perils from the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in labor and travail, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Besides those things that are without, there is that which presseth upon me daily, anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is caused to stumble and I burn not? You know, this almost sounds a little bit strong, or at least it used to sound a little bit strong, I should say. I'm not sure it does anymore. In our modern society. But there was a day and age in our society when boasting of this nature just didn't fit in well with Western values. Boasting, at least in days gone by, has almost always been considered brash and impolite. But again, in Paul's day, it was not so. Keep in mind that most of these folks had no anticipation of a life after death. And if they were going to have any kind of immortality, it was going to be in bragging about what they were and what their accomplishments had been and making some kind of record of that. And so boasting was a rather common thing back then. Citizens and soldiers alike, without embarrassment and as a social convention, really tried to outdo one another in setting forth their accomplishments, whether they were military or personal. We do see some of this in our age. They were listed on monuments, they were listed on public buildings. They may be depicted in a household mural where you would come to visit me at my house and I would say, well, first look at this wall and see how really a great person has honored you by inviting you into my home. They would have it, like I say, on a household mural or set it forth in some kind of epic narrative. The res gestae of the Emperor Augustus is a good example in that he proudly recounted his many victories, his official positions in Roman society, successfully completed buildings, and all of his other accomplishments. Boasting was common among the Jews. Remember Luke 18? Lord, I thank thee that I am not as other men, especially this publican. It was a common thing to boast in that day. And here Paul now finally brings him to this, to him, distasteful task. He begins by saying, yeah, I've heard what my opponents have had to say, and I'm going to answer it all. I'm not going to leave anything unaddressed. So the first 3 claims that Paul responds to, or I guess you could say 3 aspects of the same claim, is their claim to their great Jewish heritage. And obviously they had said of Paul, you know, you can't be sure about him. And Paul says, are they Hebrews? Me too. Are they Israelites? Me too. Are they descendants of Abraham? Me too. Well, what's the difference in those 3 words? How many of you see any difference in those 3 words? Well, you're sort of like me. But I will tell you that people, act like they've never heard of synonyms. And try to make distinctions. And people very often, I think, try to read way too much into how the Bible reads. And they take the language and they try to make, some significant thing out of the use of this word. And the truth of the matter is, the Bible wasn't written in theological language. They didn't have a theological dictionary back then. They used common, everyday Greek or Aramaic. And they wrote it. You can go back and look at the ancient papyri. Well, we have a lot of biblical manuscripts. If you're in the Wednesday night class, you're learning something about that. At least the one in the auditorium. But they've got some that are contracts between people. Some that look like they're an ancient counterpart to a grocery list that somebody might take to the store. A memorandum, a letter. And those folks are using the same words. The Bible was written in common, everyday language. Now some folks say, well, Hebrews is something special. And there probably are some small distinctions here. The term Hebrews seems to be distinguished in Scripture from the Hellenists. If you go to Acts 6, the Hellenists, who were also Jews in Jerusalem following Pentecost, were complaining that their widows were being neglected in the daily ministration. And the Bible talks about them as being Hellenists. And so the Hebrew is generally considered to be the person who was from Jerusalem, the holy city, who was born there, who was raised there, who had Jewish parents, Hebrew parents, who spoke Aramaic or Greek as his native tongue. That was the Hebrew. The Hellenist was the Jew of the dispersion. Peter wrote to those folks. And many of them had long since lost their Aramaic language. And their first language was not Aramaic, but the common Greek of the Hellenist area. And so they were considered maybe to be Israelites. Some say, well, that's not really the distinction to be made. Hebrew has to do with race. And when Paul said, so am I, he elsewhere said, I am a Hebrew of Hebrews. My mom and daddy were Jews, just like yours. And though he was born in Tarsus, if you know your Bible, he went to Jerusalem. And that's where he had his upbringing, apparently. They wanted to be sure he got the best education of the day. And he sat at the feet of Gamaliel. And he spoke in Aramaic when he was in Jerusalem. So that was his language. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? Some folks think that is the social and religious aspect. Are they descendants of Abraham? Have they got the right lineage? They just ignore what the true seed of Abraham is. But at any rate, that if there's any distinction to be made, that is the distinction. And Paul just looks at it and says, are they? Well, is Paul admitting that they are? He's asking a question. The question, are they, says they claim to be. And that is really important when you get down the list a little bit, and he speaks of servants of Christ in connection with those people. Are they servants of Christ? They claim to be servants of Christ. Paul, having called them false apostles, wasn't about to admit that these folks were really servants of Christ. There is in argument an expression assuming arguendo. And that means assuming for the sake of argument And whenever you hear that, you can just really understand that whatever a polemicist, somebody who is debating, is arguing for the sake of argument, or admitting for the sake of argument, is something that he does not really believe. So Paul is not admitting that these people that he called false apostles are anything, and he's saying, you know, here, look at this, I'm equal to them. Are they this? I am. Are they this? I am. Are they this? I am. And then all of a sudden, Paul gets busy. When it comes to matters of nationality, he's equal to them. But when it comes to achievement, he says, boys, they can't even tie my shoes. Now, that's a biblical expression. I'm not worthy to unlace the shoes of him who comes after me. Well, these folks were not worthy to unlace the shoes of the Apostle Paul. And so when he gets down to achievements, and he starts comparing himself with the super apostles, or the false apostles, as he's described them, using both designations, he first starts with equality, and he winds up with superiority. I've had it more frequently. I've had it more severely. I've accomplished more. Is this list that Paul gives us here a complete list of all of his trials and tribulations? Absolutely not. How do we know that? Because this letter was written around Acts chapter 20 and verse 2, as far as the history is concerned. And by this time, you know, Paul says how many times that he had been beaten with a rod? I don't recall offhand.
Three times.
How many of them had occurred here? One. Philippi, where he was in the Philippian jail. He and Paul and Silas sing. That was a Roman beating. Beaten with rods. And that was an unmerciful beating. How many times had he received 40 stripes save one? Five. Hadn't but one or two of those occurred by this time. Hadn't all of the nights in the deep occurred here? The one we know of occurred after this. But Paul spent some time in the sea, clinging on to, what do they call it? Flotsam and jetsam. I don't know the difference of those two things either. But it's something that came off a boat that sunk, and you hang on to it for dear life. And Paul did that, days and nights in the deep. He never had to endure a bell. Paul had a much more colorful life even than what we know about, if colorful is the right word to describe it. And bless his heart, he's reluctant to tell folks about it.
His colors were black and blue, weren't they?
They were. His colors were black and blue. He suffered for the cause of Jesus Christ. I don't know why, except he preached the gospel. And he preached it in areas and under conditions that brought this upon him, even being stoned in Lystra and left for dead. But what we do know is, that before he became a child of God, he did the same thing to God's children. And now as he proclaims the gospel, that which he did to the children of God, those who oppose the children of God are behaving toward him exactly as he behaved toward the children of God before he became a child of God. Don't have time to go through all of these things and talk about them. But let's skip hurriedly to, well, a couple of things we just got to talk about. Two things. Number one, I expect the thing that hurt him more than anything else for the last two, or two in that list, I think one is the last, and that is perils of false brethren. Nothing is worse than to be attacked by false brethren, particularly brethren who used to be true brethren and who departed from the faith in some manner and can't stand those who remain true to it. And then anxiety for all the churches. Well, did Paul violate the teaching of Jesus? Be anxious for nothing. That's what he wrote, by the way, to the Philippians. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication. Make your requests known unto God. No. Because Paul wasn't anxious about tomorrow. He was dealing with the problems of today. And he was concerned about the church of God. He was concerned about the people of God. He wasn't concerned for himself. He wanted them to be true to the faith. And you and I ought to want the same thing and be concerned about it. And concerned enough about it to do something about it. Because if we don't, we don't love the Lord any more than those who have gone away from his word. Then finally, let's look at the closing verses. Some folks think these closing verses really go with the next chapter. I faced that situation once before and I left Eric two verses and I've never heard the end of it. So we will talk about these three verses and let him do as he will. Well, why did Paul put this here? His departure from Damascus. His rather embarrassing departure from Damascus. Because from what we know of the Apostle Paul, he would rather stand and look them in the eye, even if it meant a beating or personal discomfort of some type. But here he is sneaking out of Damascus at night in a fish basket. I expect it was a smelly fish basket. Where is Paul? In Damascus. Where was Paul going when he saw the Lord on the road to Damascus? Paul's first great persecution, if this be a persecution, occurred in the place where he had gone to imprison the people of God. I don't know how the Corinthians were feeling about now. But if they had the right feeling, for this man who was their father in Jesus Christ, and who wanted to present them as a chaste virgin unto the Lord, I expect they were feeling about like they could be hid under a thimble. May God bless us to read and study His Word and to be faithful to it in spite of what people may say or people may do. Because not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven. If you came in after we passed out the purple cards, if you will wait just long enough to get one, I would appreciate it, and I will explain them to you. Thank you for your presence this morning.